This episode is sponsored by Lockheed Martin. At Lockheed Martin, veterans are at the center of everything they do. In fact, one in five of their employees has served in uniform. Lockheed Martin is proud to help men and women like you successfully transition into civilian careers. Join Lockheed Martin and you will find opportunities to take on the same kind of long-term, challenging assignments you tackled while in the military. Whether you're on active duty, transitioning, or already embarking on your civilian career, Lockheed Martin's Military Connect is your online community for professional support. You can find out more at lockheedmartin.bravenew.com. That's lockheedmartin.bravenew.com. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to help military veterans thrive in their civilian career. Today's episode number 211 with Dennis Clancy.
You know, we have so many veterans taking off their uniform, but they still want some way to engage and serve. And Team Rubicon provides that opportunity. We believe that, you know, on a homeowner's worst day, the best thing to do is to get military veterans out in front of those people to create solutions and to help them kind of rebuild after something that can be pretty devastating.
Well, my guest today is a real Renaissance man. He started his career at Amazon before transitioning to one of the nation's preeminent nonprofits, Team Rubicon. Along with that, he has done the running of the bulls over 80 times in the last 12 years and even directed a documentary about his experience. Team Rubicon is an organization that should be on every veteran's radar. They unite the skills and experiences of military veterans with first responders to rapidly deploy emergency response teams around the world. This meets a need for purpose, connection, contribution, and excitement that many guests on my show have expressed they missed after their military service. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Dennis. Joining me today in Dallas, Texas is Dennis Clancy. Dennis, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thanks for having me on, Justin.
So for listeners, I wanted to give you some context. Dennis is the Deputy Director of Field Operations for Team Rubicon, which is a nonprofit organization that unites the skills and experiences of military veterans with first responders to rapidly deploy emergency response teams. He started out at West Point, after which he served in the Army for over 6 years, earning a Bronze Star for combat leadership. Since his military service, he has worked at Amazon as an operations manager and as the director of the documentary Chasing Red. So Dennis, maybe to start things off, could you share with listeners a little bit more about what your first job search was like out of the military?
Oh man, it was interesting. So my father was in the military as well. And so the military was really all that I knew when I got out. Thinking back to it now, you know, my first impression of the process of finding a civilian job was that, one, that, you know, there are a lot of recruiters out there. Those recruiters make money by very quickly and efficiently putting you in the right spot. And so I think it can be normal sometimes to feel as if you're a number in the process. The thing to remember in all that is, yeah, you're a number, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. And all those recruiters do want to make sure that you're finding the right fit for yourself. So, you know, I think the thing that I learned in the process of that was I needed to be a bit patient, make sure that I was, you know, stepping into, you know, that first opportunity that really matched what I could be passionate about and not, you know, just kind of take what came along for a bit of security. And really that first move out of the military, I think, is so critical because it can set up the trajectory for the rest of your life.
That's great. I think it is great to remember, too, that I'm sure the recruiters do have the best interest of the person at heart. But also it's, you know, they are incentivized, like you said, to get placed rapidly. And so I like that perspective of having some patience and really waiting to find the right job for you. And only you know what that job is. And also, I think it's a good reminder to make sure that listeners have enough money saved up so that they can wait to take the best job and not have to take a job right away, because sometimes it could take a little while to figure out what that ideal job would be.
Yeah, and I can tell you, I didn't really have a plan. I luckily I had a supportive family who was cool with me, you know, hanging out at my parents' house for the summer months as I kind of deliberated all over the, you know, with the different options. But I remember getting the first few offers and seriously considering them. And now I look back and I'm like, man, that I would have been miserable if I had taken those opportunities. So yeah, I think that financial stability, being able to kind of catch your breath and really, you know, take the best opportunity that comes along, and that might not be the first one you get.
And was Amazon the first job you had out of the military?
It was, yeah. So joined Amazon kind of, I got out at the beginning of July of 2010, and I joined Amazon about 4 months later.
And was that through a recruiter, or how did that job offer come about?
Man, I believe it was. It's hard to remember now. The thing I remember most is there was a really good military recruiter at Amazon at the time. I'm sure the talent's still there. Philip Dana, who sold me on taking the job by talking about moving millions of copies of Harry Potter books, made that really sexy. And that was the last conversation I remember having before I said, yeah, okay, sign me up. Let's do this.
That's awesome. Well, there's a lot in your background I want to talk about, but I want to start with Team Rubicon. I'm betting that most listeners have heard of Team Rubicon before. You guys have a very strong reputation and presence, but could you share more about your mission at Team Rubicon and what sorts of things you do?
Yeah, sure. In my role, I oversee all of Team Rubicon's disaster operations. So that's international and domestic. We respond to natural disasters, in some case, man-made disasters. Internationally, we're very medically focused. So we just got our World Health Organization verification as an emergency medical team, so we can get tasked out across the world to send medical teams. But there are a lot of disasters that happen right here in the United States. We were founded about 8 years ago. A couple of guys who had just taken off their uniform were seeing all of the devastation with the Haiti earthquake, decided that there was something they could do to affect that disaster. They were able to affect it. They amassed a team of about eight people that grew to I think a couple dozen. But they came back to the U.S. recognizing, you know, that great feeling of hey, we still have something to give to our communities, and realized how much of an opportunity there is to affect disasters within our own borders even. And so the majority of the work we do is right here in the United States. I mean, if you look at last hurricane season, we're going into what may be a pretty brutal one right now. Last year we had Harvey, Irma, and Maria affecting Texas, the whole Gulf Coast, Florida, multiple places in the Caribbean, Puerto Rico. And so, you know, we have so many veterans taking off their uniform, but they still want some way to engage and serve. And Team Rubicon provides that opportunity. We believe that, you know, on a homeowner's worst day, the best thing to do is to get military veterans out in front of those people to create solutions and to help them kind of rebuild after something that can be pretty devastating.
That's great. I mean, I love one of the trends that I've seen. This is, I think, the 210th interview that I've done. And in many of the interviews I've done up until now, a common thread is that when people leave the military, they miss that sense of purpose, and they also miss connection with the people they're serving with. And what I respect about what Team Rubicon is doing is I can see how that really meets those needs, that veterans who work with you, they're getting that sense of purpose, they're having an impact, and they're also surrounded by other veterans, which can be a great sense of community. And so it seems like you're punching a bunch of tickets for the people who serve you, and at the same time, you're providing an incredible service to the country and the world at large. It's a beautiful way that you guys have combined those two things.
I also think that we're driving a somewhat different veteran narrative than you hear a lot, right? Obviously, you know, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have put a toll on our service men and women. And obviously there are a lot of people that are kind of struggling after those events and need some sort of help. They need some way to reconnect. They need an outlet, and they need assistance. But there's also a very large group of veterans who, you know, just have come out of the military with these great skills. And we just believe if we can put those skills to use in some purpose, that, I mean, that's the outlet that they're craving for, and who better to do it than, you know, these leaders, these men and women who have learned these great soft skills, dealing with chaotic situations all over the globe. You know, for every MOS there's in a, you know, in the military, they train you for just about anything that could, you know, you would have to solve for in a disaster situation. So we want to make sure that we're leveraging that huge group of people. And also allowing, you know, people around the globe and here domestically that, you know, veterans aren't always in a place where they need help. They just need an outlet for these great skills they have. Like, they are some of the best and brightest in this country, and giving them that tool to be able to affect disasters is really powerful. You know, in many ways, it's not so much that, you know, Team Rubicon does not exist to provide veterans opportunities. It exists to affect communities during disasters. We just believe the best tool for doing that is the veteran.
That's great. And let's get tactical. Let's say someone listening right now is, I don't know, let's say they're located in San Diego. They just got out of the military. They're fired up. They want to be involved with Team Rubicon. What does that look like?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's really quick to go on the website, sign up. And I should also say we're not 100% veteran. We have we're about 25% what we call kick-ass civilian, because we recognize there are people from all walks of life. We have a lot of medical providers, people that come out of, you know, EMT, police, fire, who can really bring something to the table. And you can't really talk about veteran reintegration if you don't involve people that are not veterans. So, literally anyone can raise their hand and join Team Rubicon if they feel like they have what it takes. It takes about 20 seconds initially to get signed up on the website. It's teamrubiconusa.org. And from there, you know, there's additional follow-on training. But yeah, we want to make sure that people have opportunities to get out and help us be awesome.
What's that look like? So I sign up, it takes 20 seconds. Well, I'll add the link to the show notes. Where does it go from there? Like, what does the training look like? And then when there is a disaster, what happens with the people who are involved?
Yeah, definitely. So initially, once you sign up, you'll also go through a background check just to make sure there's, you know, if you're going to be sleeping, obviously, in close quarters with other people during disasters, we want to make sure that everyone is safe. We also have culture training that we do to make sure every member has a basic understanding of who we are and what our values are. In addition to that, you'll take basic incident command system training. That's really FEMA's system for how to manage a disaster. That's something that the organization teaches. We have an agreement to be able to teach high level courses of ICS. One, so that we're seen as kind of easy to integrate into command structures during large disasters. But it's also how we structure our own command system in our responses. So everyone has a bit of understanding there. And then from there, someone's eligible once they go through that training, which again is probably, you know, another few hours of training right there. You're eligible. So when a disaster happens, if it's within a radius, typically our disasters, if you're within 450 miles, will allow you to drive to that disaster. We will cover mileage reimbursement for getting to and from. We obviously figure out, we cover the lodging, we cover the meals, cover, you know, personal protective equipment during the disaster. And for people that want to get involved with more specialized skills, we have additional follow-on training people can do on weekends for chainsaw, for damage assessment, heavy equipment. We have a variety of different tracks people can take if they want to get more involved with one technical specialty within our quiver.
And the different trainings you're talking about,
Are those, is that in one location? Is it in multiple locations, or where does that training take place? Like the initial onboarding training?
So the initial onboarding is online, and someone can do that themselves right from their computer, and they can be done within 4 hours. They put in that background check that might take a week to clear. Yeah, it may be upfront investment of I think people can do it in as little as 2 or 3 hours. Yeah, they can all do that from their computer. And then for all that follow-on training, we do it all over the United States. We even have what we call the mobile training center. It's a giant RV that's got all of our training equipment on it. It's got chainsaws, it's got class aids and all that. And we actually have contractors that drive that. It's a fifth wheel, and there's a F-350 Ford truck that drives that thing all over the country, delivering trainings to people so that they're ready to go when a disaster hits.
That's awesome. So you're punching on a bunch of things. It's a sense of purpose, connection with other veterans, impact on the world, but also a tremendous amount of fun. It sounds like learning how to operate chainsaws and heavy equipment, and it sounds like a fun way to spend a weekend as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so our members, when they sign up for a response, in some cases they can only give a day or they can give a weekend. In a lot of cases, people are asked to take a week to give up. But we work with our volunteers because we recognize they only have so much time in the year that they can give up. And we're grateful for whatever days they're able to provide. We just want to facilitate getting them into the field and having impact on communities.
What's the size of this? Like, how many people are on your list, or just kind of roughly how many people have gone through this process?
Yeah, so our big number of people that have signed up for Team Rubicon is 80,000, which is pretty
Wow.
phenomenal considering we've only been around for 8 years.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And what was your path from Amazon to Team Rubicon? Like, how did you end up getting involved?
Man, it's a bit of a weird story. So I'm sure at some point we'll talk about running with bulls and shooting this film and this documentary in Spain. There was a guy who slept in my bathtub in Spain because I was all out of room in the apartment one fiesta during the running of the bulls. And he later deployed with Team Rubicon in 2013 to Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines. And so I really learned about Team Rubicon through Facebook. And when I was at Amazon, I really never had time to give up, to volunteer. I mean, it was really my life. It wasn't until after I left that I felt like there was a pocket in my life where I could sign up and potentially deploy. And it just so happened that in 2015 there was the Nepal earthquake, and I signed up for that. And given my logistics background, was selected to go to help with logistics for that response, and never turned back. I just loved it.
That's awesome. And maybe for listeners, you could kind of help them deconstruct your title. So your title's Deputy Director of Field Operations. Walk us through, like, what does that translate to? And sometimes what's most helpful, if you were to pick, I don't know, last Friday or a random day, and just kind of walk us through your day, it's always helpful for listeners to get a sense of what a day in your shoes looks like.
Yeah, and I could talk about today really, because obviously we have a number of hurricanes that are headed towards. We have one headed towards Hawaii, one headed up the Gulf, two out in the Atlantic. We also have one passing over Guam at this moment. So, in my role of overseeing and supporting all of our disaster operations, I lead our National Operations Center here in Dallas, Texas. We chose Dallas really because it's geographically central to the U.S. Also geographically central to the disasters that we experience domestically. But DFW is also obviously a great travel hub. And so we have DFW Airport just up the road from us, and it's a good place to launch for international as well. Our National Operations Center has about 25 employees to date. And really the nerve center of it is our Emergency Operations Center. We have a lead of logistics, mobilization for personnel, plans, technology, finance, public affairs, kind of all those major shops that you could imagine are in charge of supporting different aspects of an operation. And so this is kind of the nerve center for the organization, making sure that we have good situational understanding of what threats are where. So we put out a daily, a member of my team in plans puts out a daily threat brief to inform everyone in the organization what current disasters are we looking at and what might develop over the next 24 to 48 hours. And then we also hold a number of planning calls. So today, for example, after this call, I'm jumping on a call with the Northeast who are looking at Hurricane Florence. In between that, I'm talking to a team we still have out in Hawaii from the last hurricane, Hurricane Lane. They're still doing recovery work, and now they're going to be impacted by another hurricane. We need to do some planning around how they stay safe during this next hurricane. And then our Southeast also has a planning call later today. So that's probably going to eat up a lot of the day, just making sure everyone gets synced, understands who will take control of what disaster if it hits where. So it's a lot of just getting in front of these disasters, making sure everyone's on the same page. We have, in addition to our national staff that I'm part of, we have deputy directors at the territory level. So we have 6 territories within the United States. And so they have a certain degree of responsibility for making sure that there's readiness of the members in their area and the equipment in their area so that we can quickly respond. The way we're going to get quicker and quicker at responding to disasters if we're increasingly local. And so they're really helping to grow us at the city and district level, as well as the state and region, so that we're always prepared. But we also have people that are very close and very tied into the existing disaster architecture, the local county EMs, the emergency managers, all this stuff.
So given, I appreciate the context there, and I'm just wondering, given the nature of your work, is your schedule end up being just really wildly unpredictable because you have these disasters hit, and I imagine then you have to spend a ton of time there? And I'm just kind of curious the lifestyle impact for you.
Yeah, no, it's very irregular, and it's definitely based around disasters. I can say the thing that makes that very easy for me is the fact that, every time we go to a disaster, I know the impact we're having. We're really good at being able to quantify the impact we're having. We're good at communicating all the metrics, how many homeowners we helped, what sort of economic impact we had on a community. And I think that for me and for my team makes this really, really easy. That, yeah, it's a lot of late nights. It's a lot of staying up till 4 a.m. so we can get a plan out because people are moving at 06. But it's always rewarding what we're doing, and that's what really fuels us.
And I want to ask about your documentary, but just 2 other questions about just working at a nonprofit in general. I'm wondering, for someone who's listening, who's already interested in joining a nonprofit, do you have any thoughts about your route in getting there? Was you had a significant amount of corporate experience before transitioning into a nonprofit. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on whether that's a path you would advise, or if you would recommend someone going directly into a nonprofit, or just how to evaluate the trade-offs on those 2 different paths.
Yeah, and I think to your point earlier, when you said, when you're getting out of the military, make sure you have a good financial footing. One of the things that really set me up for success at Team Rubicon was the fact that I had a very good financial footing coming out of Amazon, right? I was pretty smart about it. I was always kind of thinking of what was that next chapter in my life, and I wanted to make sure that I was ready for it. Going from the military directly into a nonprofit, I think can be tricky. There are a lot of people that do it, and there are a lot of people that get a lot of reward out of it. A lot of our employees go, are people that came out of the military and came almost directly into this line of work. There are a lot of opportunities out there, but I think the thing to recognize is that it's a different trajectory of salary. I definitely don't get paid as much as I have in former roles that I've had, but it's good that I was at a place where I could make a very sound decision about that. And I, it wasn't kind of a It wasn't kind of, hey, I needed to take an opportunity. It was more like, hey, this is something I could really invest myself in and get pretty passionate about. And so I think that's really important, not to put yourself on kind of an island. Everyone's always thinking, hey, what's the career trajectory? And, you know, thinking about what the next move would be for me, I don't see myself leaving Team Rubicon anytime soon. But if I were to start thinking about it, it does become a little more complicated if I start looking at how do I go back in the for-profit sector. But I think with any job, it's, you know, going after any job, it's really just being a good storyteller, understanding the impact you had on the organization you were at. You know, no one cares so much, you know, what's your experience level, how much responsibility you have. A lot of times you see resumes that are really built around, you know, I was in charge of this many people and this many dollars of equipment. Like, I think for any savvy forward-thinking company out there, they really don't care about that stuff. What they really care about is, what impact did you individually have? What sort of solutions did you come up with to unique unique problems? And that's what will really drive your career and allow you to be very flexible to jump into whatever industry you want to go into.
That's great, and I think it's just an incredible example of how you built up career capital at Amazon, and you were smart about saving money, and then you were able to use both of those to maybe find something that was more aligned with your values, or find something that got you more excited on a personal level, and were able to take that significant pay cut because of how you had planned in advance. I think that's just a powerful reminder for listeners. And could you talk about, you've got a very unique component of your background, which is you've actually founded a travel and documentary film production company that's called Margin Fade. How did that come about?
Yeah, it kind of all started at West Point. You know, the nice thing about West Point is that it's an hour north of New York City. And because it's sometimes so miserable to be at, you need some sort of release when you're not there. But you don't have that much time that you can actually take away from being there. And so you want to make the most of it. For a lot of people, you know, New York City is really the terminus of that ability to get away. But for me, it was always a gateway. So I started this club when I was there that we called, almost jokingly, the Extreme Vacationing Club. We'd find the cheapest flight into Europe on a weekend. And we had some, you know, list of tasks we had to accomplish on a regular weekend. Sometimes, in some cases, it was 21 hours or 54 hours on the ground. You know, if you take off from New York at 7 p.m. on a Friday night, you take a direct flight into Europe, you got 8 hours to sleep on the plane, and you touch down, it's 8 a.m, you're ready to hit the ground running. And that really drove a passion for me about travel. And I've always wanted to be able to capture it in a way to allow people to see what I was learning from all this traveling that I was doing. You know, I think we all know it's obnoxious to drop place names or drop people's names, right? It doesn't so much matter how many places you've been, or what really matters is, what have you gotten out of those experiences? Have you grown through those experiences? And so, you know, travel became that thing that I think I'm still to this day most passionate about. And Margin Fade was an opportunity to say, hey, how can I not just write about the experiences I'm having, how can I film it in a way that communicates something to an audience and really drive some discussion about what travel should be, or what's the responsibility of the traveler and such. And the first project I took on as part of that was the running of the bulls, because it was it's still to me a very interesting topic, and one that I think is can be very difficult to understand, and perhaps we're not supposed to understand it. I don't know.
that's a great lead-in. I mean, talk to us about how you got, like, what led you to it, and what was that experience like, and how many times have you done this?
Yeah, I deployed to Iraq in the Army 2005 to 2006. That was my, you know, first job, platoon leader, 101st Airborne Division, southwest of Baghdad. And I came back from that experience pretty empowered, I think. You know, it was a good experience for me, I think, as in terms of personal development, in terms of the ways that I was challenged, in terms of the ways that I gained confidence in dealing with very difficult situations. And the following summer, 2007, I went to Spain to run with the Bulls, and I got on that run route. It's a half mile run. Really, you don't even sign up. You just get on the run route. And at 8 a.m., they release a rocket and the Bulls take off. They run a 4-minute mile through about 3,000 people over about 848 meters. And it can be over in 2 minutes. But the panic that you see on people on that route who are running for the first time and have no idea what's happening can be a bit overwhelming. And so I felt really uncomfortable running with the Bulls the first time. But I knew there were people that got out there every day and it kind of overcome that sense of feeling overwhelmed. And I felt as if, you know, I could probably figure that out. And so I committed myself in 2007 to work on a film project, but also commit myself as a runner of Bulls. And so now I've run for 12 years, probably close to about 80 times with Bulls, both in Pamplona and some other towns in Spain. But yeah, it's really become a passion for me. You know, the other outlet for me was that, you know, being a young officer in the Army, you know, I had to be that guy at the end of the day that had a plan for my guys when things went wrong. And so in Pamplona, I've carved out a bit of a personality for myself as the guy who, if you're coming to run for the first time and you have no idea what you're doing, I have clients every summer. This summer was about 425 clients, where I walk people along the run route, explain to them all the ins and outs, what to do, what not to do, what are the risks they're taking on. Because I like being that guy in town who can kind of help people through what is a very stressful and can be a very dangerous and bad decision.
I'm sure that we could go into great length about this, but if someone listening were thinking of running the Bulls, where would you advise them to even start with this?
So I do have a YouTube video up. It's 18 minutes. It's called The Definitive Guide to Running the Bulls. If you type in how to run with Bulls, it's always the top result on YouTube. It gives someone the basics, allows them to understand the main risks and the main do nots. And that's really the first place to go. It really covers everything.
Great. I'll add a link for listeners to both your documentary as well as that YouTube clip. And I'm wondering, you know, what was it like creating that documentary? It looks like you started this on Kickstarter. And could you just kind of take us through the whole process of creating this full-length documentary?
Yeah, absolutely. It was really a labor of love. It took me a significant number of years to make it. You know, I had this idea first in 2007. And for about the next 4 years, I just called it the Pamplona Project because I didn't even know what I wanted to call it and had no background in film whatsoever. But I think that was part of the challenge of it. You know, I had a very rewarding and demanding career at Amazon at the time. So I only really had a little bit here and there that I could really dedicate to the project. But decided, you know, through my network and the people that knew about my travel, I could probably crowdfund enough money to be able to produce it. That initial Kickstarter was about $23,000, and that was my principal production budget. So that doesn't really go far when you're trying to shoot a documentary in another country. 14 grand went out the door with flights. I told my cameraman I couldn't afford to pay him, but I could fly them to and feed them through, you know, one of the most amazing life experiences they would ever have. And I was able to leverage a lot of local resources. So had some friends in the town that also had access to cameramen and were willing to help and provide footage so we could get, you know, coverage. The difficult thing about shooting in these very tight cavernous alleyways is, you know, you only have so many seconds that the camera can get the bulls before you're onto the next camera. And it's a character driven documentary, so you want to be able to show your runners with the bulls, and that's very difficult. But a lot of things came together. A lot of people believed in the project and believed in me, I think, even before I even believed in myself to some degree. But I, you know, I made sure that I maintained a career outside of this. You know, I put in the amount of time that I had each year. Finally, I got to 2011. I was like, hey, I need to shoot a pilot for this. We crowdfunded the resources in 2012, and we filmed it in 2012. I didn't actually finish film until about 2015. And that's when I was on a film festival circuit, and the Nepal earthquake hit, and I started Team Rubicon. But yeah, I think, you know, not trying to do it overnight, recognizing what my gaps were, understanding that I didn't have any background in film whatsoever, and having the patience with myself to learn all those things, to build a team of people that could fill in the gaps that I had, really made that film a success.
That's so great. I find it inspiring to think of this as a creative outlet. And I was about to ask about how to do that on the side, but I love what you're saying of that patience. It sounds like it started with the honesty of understanding where your weaknesses and blind spots were, and then a tremendous amount of patience to learn those skills and develop a team and grow this. But I can only imagine the amount of work it took doing this on the side, but also the amount of charisma it required to get the team working with you to create the documentary, to get people to believe in you and invest in making this happen. And I can only imagine how fulfilling it must have been to finally end the shooting and the editing and everything and get this out there.
Yeah, you know, when I look at the amount of credit I can give myself, it definitely pales in comparison to, you know, the amazing generosity of so many people, not only with their financial resources, but just their intellect, their own creativity to really make this happen. I couldn't have done it on my own. And a lot of people sacrificed a lot to help me, you know, see that dream come true.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You're like a Swiss Army knife, so I have to dive into one other area. But I saw that you're involved with the board of directors for the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. Could you share a little bit more about your work there?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a role I've been in for the last 6 months. I'm at a point in my career where I'm starting to look at where else can I kind of pitch in the humanitarian space. Obviously, one of the places that's still really near and dear to my heart is Iraq. You know, that the battlefield there, I think, was very formative to my young adult life. And, you know, I came away from that experience with an intense admiration of the people there. You know, there in every conflict, you have people that are agitators, and then you have the vast majority of people who are trying to create some degree of normalcy for their families, for their children, who just want peace. And you know, I still have a lot of relationships with people that I knew from my time there, and it's never been that far from my mind. And so through a friend I work with, got an opportunity to take the role of vice president on their board of directors. It's the, as you said, Education for Peace in Iraq Center. The organization, puts out a very good product called Isham, which is a monitoring report of everything that's going on in Iraq on a weekly basis. And so they do a phenomenal job of monitoring, assessing, and informing people that are engaged in that theater. In addition to that, they partner for a number of programs to increase the safety and kind of normalcy of the lives of Iraqis. And so, you know, it's a role that I am still figuring out how much I can give to it and in what ways I can help kind of form the future of the organization. I've been helping with a lot of things just recently, including We're hiring on a communications manager, a communications and development manager right now. But it's an amazing organization. The founder, Eric Gustafson, he's a Gulf War vet. He's been kind of involved with issues surrounding Iraq since before the 2003 invasion, and has really built out an amazing network there. And it helps to keep me connected with a part of my past and, you know, maintain a bit of a commitment that I feel to the people there that really gave me so much through my experiences in Iraq.
Well, Dennis, I always like to keep the last question open-ended, and we've covered a lot of ground between your work at Amazon and your first career search and Team Rubicon and the work you're doing there and documentary filmmaking and running of the Bulls and then the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. What have we not covered that you want to make sure listeners know before we wrap up?
Oh, man. It's not a bad question. There was a chapter of my life in between Amazon that I actually started an export company in Tempe, Arizona, with guys that some venture capital guys I met over some scotch at my favorite restaurant in Phoenix, the Gladly, and ran that for about 6 months until I got whisked away into the Team Rubicon venture. But I think, you know, sometimes you got to take risks, I guess. And that was one that I think, you know, within a 6 month period, learned tons from. You know, I think there are three kind of branches of jobs, and anyone listening they probably can think of more, right? But we have public service, and I put, you know, the military kind of in that bucket. You have kind of large corporations, which people, you know, typically go into after the military, right? Because they provide the most amount of jobs, obviously, and the most amount of stability. But, you know, I saw it as like one further step to kind of go out on my own and be kind of master my own destiny beyond, you know, a massive corporation like Amazon, which really gave me so much professional knowledge that I could really set a foundation for. And so, you know, my work with Chasing Red, the documentary film, and then also Planet Exports, this export company, was really that final evolution of really getting to where I felt I was away from any big system, and it was really just I had to figure it out for myself. And I think having gone to that end of the sphere has given me a pretty broad perspective of kind of all segments of the workforce, which I'm really grateful for.
Well, this is great, Dennis. I appreciate the example you are for the veteran community. I appreciate the work that you're doing with Team Rubicon, and also for joining us today and sharing your story.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks so much for having me, Justin. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Beyond the Uniform. There are over 200 free episodes at beyondtheuniform.io. They're classified by the industry of focus, the functional role the person plays, and more. Beyond the Uniform is hosted, produced, and edited by me, Justin Asiri. Our director of outreach, responsible for sponsorship and guest episodes, is Steve Bain. Our editor, responsible for the show notes and text transcripts for all episodes, is Kathleen Dillon. Our data analytics and insights advisor is Andrew Woolridge. If you are enjoying Beyond the Uniform, you can help us out by telling your veterans and friends in the military about this free resource. There is more information on the website about how you can sponsor an episode or donate to our program to help us grow the work that we're doing. Be sure to check out the coaching section of beyondtheuniform.io, where you can be paired with professional, subsidized coaches to help you figure out your next career move. You can sign up for our newsletter to be up to date on the latest happenings at Beyond the Uniform. And in each show notes section, there is a link to audible.com, which is providing a free audiobook of your choice to Beyond the Uniform listeners. You get a free book of your choosing, and Beyond the Uniform gets $15 to subsidize the cost of the show, regardless of whether you can continue with audible.com or not. Check that out and more in the show notes for this episode. Keep the feedback coming. Let me know what resources would help you in your career, and we'll do our best to make that happen. Take care, be safe, and I'll be back next week with more interviews with military veterans about their civilian career.